we should have used has been hijacked. Fortunately, this one was vacant. And I trust the media are not too uncomfortable. We're expecting a couple of more members of the committee to join us. That's why we've left a couple of seats empty. Before we say a word of welcome to Mr. Hoffmeyer and his team, I did indicate to you that we needed to address the issue of the traditional courts bill, and this is at the request of one or two members of the committee. So I'm going to ask Mr. Jeffrey to address us, and then we'll take it from there.
Chairperson, thanks. It's actually an issue from the ANC study group, and it's really with regards to concerns on the processing of the traditional courts bill. As members will recall, some of whom were there, some of whom were not, the bill was introduced in the last parliament. There were public hearings that were conducted, and the process then was not able to be completed before the elections. There was a report that the committee and then the House adopted on the process. The bill was then revised, and it's back with us. But effectively, it's a new committee, with some members who have not considered the bill or had any involvement with the bill before. So basically, we would need to rerun the public participation process and allow the public to comment. There's also quite a backlog of, we've got a lot of legislation before us, apart from the ones that we're dealing with, harassment, trafficking, protection of personal information. As we know, we've got, we've also got Section 49, Criminal Procedure Amendment. So we've got a lot. The proposal from the ANC study group on the committee was that it would be better, given that the bill was here, we have had some public input, but we need to do it again. And given that when we were dealing with the bill, it was quite clear that there needed to be extensive hearings in the provinces, and that the bill is a Section 76 bill, which means provinces would have to hold hearings. The proposal was that we ask the minister to withdraw the bill and reintroduce it in the NCOP at the first time. The NCOP could then conduct provincial hearings and process the bill in the second half of the year, and then it could come to us as the second half rather than the first half. So that's the proposal that we wanted to put. We felt it would be better that it were a decision of the portfolio committee as a whole, and in other words, the decision being requested that I'm putting before the committee is that we agree to request the minister to withdraw the bill and reintroduce it in the National Council of Provinces as the first time.
All right. Dean Smith, followed by Steve Swart.
Chairman, having first made that proposal, I am delighted to support it.
Sounding like your leader.
I concur.
All right.
Short and sweet.
Yeah. All right. I'm glad that. Then this will be a resolution of the committee.
We have a quorum.
Well,
it's not something that needs, I think, to go to the House, right, because the minister can withdraw the bill anyway.
Yeah.
It would really be a matter of a formal decision and then a letter from the chair to the minister saying we've discussed it, considered it, we would think this would be the basis. So the minister then has a basis to do it. He isn't just being expected to do it
unilaterally
on his own.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let's resolve that. Oof. Well, Mr. Hoffmeyer. Mr. Hoffmeyer, welcome to you and your team. When I see Mr. Hoffmeyer, my mind goes back to the days when he was a member of this committee. And I learned a lot from Mr. Hoffman.
Was he the person who hijacked
it's a pleasure to have you with us. I'm going to ask you to do what others have done, and that is to introduce your team, even though we may know who they are, but just as a formality.
Thank you very much, Chair, and it's nice to be back with the committee. It's been a while since we've been called to account here, and we do like being called to account. To my left is Mr. Fox Sokupa. He's recently joined SIU. He's sort of overall in charge of coordinating our anti-corruption efforts. My right-hand side is Peter Bishop. He's our head of operations, essentially, in charge of all our papers. Next to him is Zola Ntolosi, who is in charge of our strategy development, but also is playing quite a big role in coordinating some of the various government anti-corruption initiatives. And then next to that is Marika Miller and Boy Ndala, who is essentially our communications people. I treat Marika's name in the newspaper every now and then, even though we can't keep out of the newspaper as much as we can.
All right. Thank you. We just for your knowledge and awareness, we had asked the DG of Justice, Sindane, to also be present, just so that she understands the dynamics, and in the event that questions overlap and arise for her to respond, she's able to do so. So, within your capable hands.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to take the committee through our presentation. I think if there's a question of clarity on the way, please don't. It's a small, intimate venue. So if somebody does have a question along the way, I think if they can just put up their hand, we might as well clarify as we go along. I'm going to start essentially just by giving a quick overview of the SIU, for those who may not be familiar with the organization. It started out initially as, or has its origins in the Heath Commission that was set up originally by the Eastern Cape Provincial Government. The notion was then made into an Act of Parliament in terms of the SIU Act. And I think it's easiest to understand the SIU that it functions still pretty much like a Commission of Inquiry with some added powers from those origins. So the current SIU is established by proclamation by the President, pretty much like a normal Commission of Inquiry. And I think it's important to understand that we are separate from law enforcement agencies in the more narrow sense, but we do work very closely with them. Our major functions are to investigate corruption and, importantly, also maladministration. So we can investigate matters that do not constitute a crime, so not following proper procedure. Where there was sort of added teeth given to the SIU in terms of the Act, different from a normal Commission of Inquiry, was the power to institute civil action to remedy the wrongdoing that was found. And there are some difficulties with that concept at the moment, and we'll talk about that more later. And then, again, like a Commission of Inquiry, each investigation that the SIU does is mandated by a specific proclamation. And the powers that we have, again, is pretty much the standard ones of a Commission of Inquiry, to subpoena, to search, to do seizures, and to question people under oath, and even to compel them to give self-incriminating evidence, with the proviso that that cannot be used in criminal proceedings, but it can be used in civil proceedings. And so just to clarify, we do not have powers of arrest or prosecution. We work there with the Scorpion, with the
Mr. Glenister, in the last time I was in this committee, we work with the Hawks essentially and the NPA when there's criminality, and we also don't have powers to take disciplinary action there. We would work with the department concerned. We very often assist them with it, but they do it in terms of their powers. Just an idea of where the SIU has come to. In the last 5 years, the organization really has had a very significant expansion. We grew from about, as I'll mention later, from about 70 people to about 600 people today. And we've moved away from a sort of fairly law enforcement origin, which consisted mainly of detectives from the old commercial branch and prosecutors, to really build a proper multidisciplinary capability consisting of forensic investigators, forensic lawyers, forensic accountants. And we've also built some real specialist capacity in the areas of cyber forensics. Those are the people that can undelete the deleted files on your computer when we need it. And the and data analysis that I'll talk a little bit more about. One of our innovations over the years has been to broaden our funding base. We get at the moment about 50% of our budget from Treasury. The other 50% we get through partnerships with different departments who essentially pay us to do investigations in that department. And the advantage of this model of the partnerships that we've built has been that it's been essentially there we compete with the private forensic companies who've been doing a lot of this work in government. We think we can do it at about 30 to 40% of the cost. But the advantage is that the extra funding that we've got through this has enabled us to really build our investigative capacity considerably. As I said earlier, a lot of what we do depend on close cooperation with others, both in law enforcement, but we also work very closely with the Accountant General and Treasury, the Revenue Services, the FIC, and then also with the various oversight bodies that have some role to play in corruption, from the Auditor General, DPSA, Public Service Commission, Public Protector, and SCOPA. The sort of areas where we've really been focusing on the last 5 years, the first one was the biggest, and that's really cases where there's fraud and corruption on a very large scale, but in multiple small cases. The social grants investigation was one of those where, you know, there were 40,000 civil servants, public servants at one stage who were receiving social grants. We investigated all 40,000 cases, plus another 100,000 or so that we found in the private sector. Public servants or others getting housing subsidies that they should not get, and those sorts of issues. Over the last 2 years particularly, our focus has really shifted to procurement-related fraud and corruption. I think there's been a big emphasis from government on these issues over the last 2 years, and a lot of what I'll be talking to that covers that sort of new focus area. We also work with departments to improve their systems and processes to prevent corruption, because it's really when you investigate what's gone wrong, you can see where the loopholes and the gaps are, and we do believe strongly that, you know, we shouldn't just be reactive, but part of what we should be doing is to leave the system better than we found it after, so that we don't have to go back a year later. And then I think the other area that has been, I think, an important one over the last few years is, in a sense, to use data analytics, data mining, to, with the wealth of data that government has, to try and find evidence of irregularities proactively. So just a straightforward example, if you look at all your suppliers and your supplier database, you can compare the addresses of different suppliers. And if they share the same address, then it points to a potential problem. Or if they share the same telephone number, or bank account number, or VAT registration number. And I think this has become a very potent tool, because initially we started by doing complete audits of the whole procurement system. It is a very slow and painful process. But with the data mining, essentially you can focus your investigation on areas where you're more likely to find things wrong. So what we've done here, and I think it's been very useful, is to... One of the problems in government is that different databases don't talk to each other. So we've written programs to convert Cipro, DPI data, Home Affairs data, social grants data, housing data, PASS, which is the government payment system, PARCEL, which is the personnel system, and then the individual department supply chain databases, all into one format, so that we can now, with all the departments we work with, we can look at all their supply databases and see if there's an address that coincide with the names of the suppliers, or telephone numbers, or bank account numbers, and so on. So I think this has really become, in our engagements with Treasury and others, a very exciting way of trying to detect irregularities proactively. You don't have to wait for an auditor to find something wrong, or for some official with a sharp mind to do the comparison. You can actually, before anybody is detected, find the problems, and in many cases even stop a payment before payment is made and has to be recovered. I'm going to go very quickly through our strategy. Our vision and mission has been fairly unchanged for the last few years, as has our value. In the last year, we have changed our sort of broad strategic goal to be more in line with what government is doing. And so we've changed it to say that we want to contribute to the reduction of corruption and the perceptions of corruption, based sort of on the general goal for the justice cluster, which is that South Africans must feel safe and be safe. And we aim to do this really as a part of government's broader anti-corruption efforts. I want to highlight just those things in the new delivery agreements that deal directly with corruption. So outcome three, which is essentially the JCPS one, has an output that deals with corruption in the JCPS. There, essentially, the work that's being done at the moment is still to try and understand the scale of the problem. But this is an area where we are working in as well. And then output five is really the one targeted at corruption, and it says that we must increase investor perception and trust to invest in South Africa by taking corruption-related action in a defined number of highly visible cases. So the target that has been set for the justice cluster is to convict 100 people who are rich and important, which means that they must have more than 5 million rand that they got from corruption, and convict them within the next 3 years. That is a formidable target, given that we've probably only done about 5 of those cases in the last 10 years. And to do 100 in the next 3 years will be a challenge. Outcome 12, that's one that I think generally pertains to the Public Service and Administration Department, but they also have an output to deal with corruption in the public service, and their target that has been set there is that South Africa's position in the Transparency International Corruption Index must improve from the present rating of 55. To a rating of 40 within the next 3 years. Our strategic objectives have remained fairly unchanged. The first one is to increase the impact of our forensic services. The second one I'll talk to a bit more later, but is to try and increase the impact of our organization. We think that there are problems with our present institutional forms or weaknesses that can be improved. And the third one is really to build the cooperation with our law enforcement partners and other stakeholders. And it's been a big focus, and I think one of the reasons we've been fairly successful is these strategic partnerships that we've worked on very hard. And we also have a few internally focused strategic objectives, which is really to enable us to deliver on our external objectives, to build appropriate capacity and funding, to align. We've been through a big organizational redesign process to improve our systems and processes, partly because we had grown from a 67 to a 600 people, and our systems really started creaking under the pressure. I've talked about the importance of technology as well. That's really, we've elevated to one of our strategic objectives. And then to build an engaged, diverse, and competent SIU really speaks to employment equity, to the skills base that we want to build, and to the kind of organization and for our leadership we want the same. A quick just strategic overview. It's for the last 2 years, we cut it down from three. I think in 2019, we were faced with a recession hitting South Africa and 50% of our funding coming from government departments. We were all trying to cut expenditure. So that was a rather bleak situation to be in. We concluded our organizational design process at the time. We also moved to the five-year approach to strategic planning that government was talking about already at that time, although it's just being implemented now. And a lot of our focus was essentially to ensure that we had enough funding secured through additional work to try and compensate for the effect of the recession. I think in the past year, we've been very much become part of the different new government initiatives on corruption, and I'll talk about all those acronyms in a moment. There's been a huge increase in our impact, in our workload, and also in the funding from different departments who have approached us to help with work, and the focus shift to the procurement I've talked about. We've also, in our strategic plan, tried to align our approach to the new approach developed by the Presidency's Monitoring and Evaluation Unit, which is a results-based management with outcomes, which has been a bit of a learning curve for us investigators, but I think it has actually been a very useful, and I think the results-based approach, the logic model that goes with it, really tries to fit together how the things that individual departments work on acts together to achieve a joint outcome. And I think that has been one of the weaknesses up to now in the state and the theme of the PFMA, is that it doesn't really encourage interdepartmental work. The outcomes, the joint outcomes that have been set, I think is really focused, at least in the justice cluster, the mind of all of us and what it is we need to do together. A big part of our strategic challenge over the years, as I say, has been to build capacity in the state to investigate corruption. Our capacity has increased, as I said, from about 67 to 600. We've also had an ambitious trainee investigator challenge program to address some of the challenges in the forensic industry, which was traditionally very much dominated by detectives from the old commercial branch, from the police, and very much white male. So I think we've had quite a lot of success there, but there's certainly a lot more to be done. In the last year, because of the volume of work, we've also entered into a fairly innovative arrangement with the private sector after some discussions with Treasury. Essentially, we've employing forensic investigators from the private sector at half the Auditor General's normal rate. They are seconded to work with us on a fairly full-time basis, and I think it's one of the things that has really helped us to tackle all the new work that has been given to us. Obviously, we're also in the middle of a big recruitment drive to build our capacity, so we hope we can phase the short-term intervention up. But it has also helped us with some of the uncertainty in our funding, because at least when we're using people from outsiders, we no longer need them. We can just say goodbye and we don't have to go through the pain of retrenchment and everything. But I think, as I said, our goal does remain to try and ensure that we build a sustainable long-term capacity in the state. A lot of our work in the last year, and I think a lot of the dramatic shift that there has been in the approach of government in dealing with corruption, has been through these three key initiatives that have been taken. I think the most important one for us has been the anti-corruption task team in the Justice Cluster, and it was really set up to prioritize those 100 cases that need to be done. But it also is looking at some other high priority cases. The Act, and you'll have to learn lots of new acronyms here with us, it consists of the Hawks and the SIU that provides the main investigative capacity, as well as the prosecutors and asset forfeiture unit within the MPA. But it is also supported by Revenue Services, FIC, and the Accountant General in Treasury. The Accountant General, for those who may not know, is the person who is in charge of the PFMA, the compliance and so on of the PFMA. We have devoted considerable resources to this process, both at the strategic level, as I indicated earlier, but also we have about 25 to 30 of our investigators working full-time on this task team at the moment. The second important initiative has been the MORG, nothing to do with dead people, but the multi-agency working group in Treasury. That was set up by the Minister of Finance. It was actually the first initiative to be taken to deal with irregularities in the procurement process. And it focuses on closing the system gaps and detecting and investigating irregularities. Obviously, there's a close link between those irregularities that may be criminal of nature into the Act. And you'll see it's pretty much the same role players sitting in the two bodies, just with the roles reversed. In this one, it's law enforcement that supports the work there. And the last of the initiatives that was taken late last year was the WASP, which is an official anti-corruption unit that DPSA has set up. It's really focusing on investigation and prosecution of serious disciplinary cases against senior public servants involved in corruption. And essentially, it will be able to support the investigations and prosecutions of those cases. At the moment, the SIU is supplying a considerable part of the capacity to do the actual work for the DPSA, but I think they're doing the rebuilding their own capacity in the future. So that's on the sort of overall broader initiative. I want to just take the committee fairly briefly through our performance overview. You will see that on a number of the indicators, for example, the first one, our cash recoveries, we expect to do less in the future than we are doing now. And the reason for that is that with a lot of the current indicators are targeted at these multiple small transactions that we've been doing. With the procurement cases, we end up having to devote a huge amount of time to one investigation that often takes a year or longer. And the outcome, hopefully, there is that money hasn't yet been spent, so it shouldn't be recovered, but that we do make savings for government in the future. But you will see that the savings and the prevention of future losses, the figures also go down considerably at the moment. A lot of those savings have been through the cancellation of social grants off the system, and that project, as I will say later, is being phased out at the moment. The other indicators that we've had, which is evidence prepared for criminal action, that's essentially working with the police and the prosecuting authority. There's also been very high numbers because of the social grants investigation. We expect the numbers there to go down, but not to drop as dramatically as some of the others. The other remedial action that we measured, which is the cancellation of driving licenses, social grants, etc., there the figures go down dramatically, as you can see, as we move from the multiple small transact cases to fewer bigger cases. Disciplinary action stays roughly the same over the years. Civil litigation, a lot of our civil litigation is essentially through acknowledgements of debt that people sign before they get taken to court. Again, there the numbers drop fairly substantially. We have, in our discussions with Treasury, suggested two new indicators for the SIU, and I think that has been accepted. The one is our contribution to completed investigations of that 100 target that has been set for Treasury. And we aim to, of the 100 or so, we aim to make a contribution of about 84 in our work jointly in the anti-corruption task team. And then a second indicator that we are, those figures are a little bit of a thumb suck at the moment, but we're trying to measure the value of procurement matters where we have found irregularities. I've discussed with some of these issues already in the first bullet point and the second one. Third one is just to say that the focus of government now very much is on the procurement system, even in the social grants where we South African Social Security agencies also shifting their focus to some of their internal procurement issues. Housing, we've more or less dealt with the public servants who were getting the subsidies, and you'll have seen the minister has indicated that our big focus now is on the big housing contract. Transport essentially has indicated that they're not renewing the investigation we're having into the illegal driving license. So I think the next few points I have covered already in what I said before. I wanted to talk a little bit then about some of our key investigations. And, as I indicated, we had a total of 18 proclamations issued to us in this financial year by the President. 16 of them were new, 2 of them were the renewals of the Social Security Agency and the housing. And some of those investigations are very, very big. The public works is all procurement in public works over the last number of years. Rural development and land reform is essentially a mandate to investigate the land reform program, but I think the minister is also interested in extending it to the land restitution program. The police investigation, which is at the request of the National Commissioner, is into the procurement division of the police, and I'll talk a bit more about that. The SABC we got involved in after the initial Auditor General investigation, the Department of Arts and Culture, the National Heritage Council, and I think an interesting thing has been the Tshwane and Ekurhuleni metros. It's our first investigation at some of the big metros. Then to talk a bit about some of our bigger investigations. The TAPS, we don't have too much to report yet because a lot of the focus up to now has been on the SAPS head office procurement, which is where we supported the public protector as part of our investigation. But there are very serious irregularities in the program to build police stations. that was really what we were called in to look at in particular. It's a bit too early to say much about that at the moment, but I think there are big concerns about entire police stations worth 30 million rand being built on three quads.
And the National Commission of Police.
Yeah. Then public works, as I said earlier, we're looking at the we do have a bit more, sorry, if you look at your presentation,
yeah.
I think there's a bit more than there is on the screen. I'm sorry about that. So we are ready to say a little bit more about the police investigation. We're looking at the building of 333 police stations, where I think up to 330 million rand has been spent so far. As I indicated, a lot of these police stations are being built on three quotes, not on a tender process. So, you know, you have one quote for the desks and another quote for half the bricks and another quote for the other half of the bricks.
Okay.
But it's not, I think, a very desirable system. But we have lots, from a lot of the work that we've done, we have cases where the lowest quotations are not accepted, so where the winning bidder didn't submit a quote, possible cover quoting and BEE fronting, tax officials having interest in the work that has been awarded and the companies to work has given. And I think many cases where the actual payments exceed the budget of cost. The police stations listed there are among some of our priorities, which is Pinar, Hazy View, Brighton, Cowen. Okay, public work. I think we have finished already some of our investigations. So far we have found about 35 million rand paid to entities where public works staff have undeclared business interests. One of the matters we're investigating is the accommodation at the border post, where the contract was 374 million rand. There is a possible civil recovery of about 46 million rand. And we've also got a lease for residential accommodation in Pretoria, where the state is paying 217,000 rand a month without the relevant approval, and 7 million rand have already been paid out. In arts and culture, our investigation is just about completed there. Our findings, this was about money that was given to the department for soccer world, for the FIFA World Cup event. Our investigation has revealed that 26 million rand was moved out of that budget, which was supposed to be ring-fenced and earmarked and all that, to be spent on other items, and another 16 million rand were stayed in the budget but was used for projects that were not Soccer World Cup related. On the SABC, after the Auditor General investigation, the new board of the SABC approached the SIU to ask if we could assist with follow-up work on that investigation. You will recall that the initial SABC AG investigation had identified 20 employees who had received payments to various of their private business interests of 3.4 million. We have identified another 20 employees whose business interests received amount to 2.4 billion in that period. And there is already 8 dockets that are registered with the police that are arriving out of this investigation.
Can you not suggest that I'll make a copy of the minutes?
it does, for example, your 8 dockets, it's now what is on the board. It's 5 matches being finalized and submitted to the end.
Sorry, I should be reading
so
from
it,
that.
It just is, there's been some editing. It should be useful if you, yeah.
I have to apologize. So yeah, of those 8 matters, 5 have already been finalized and are to be submitted to the commercial, have been submitted by the police to the NPA for decision on prosecution. The Tshwane Metro, we started this investigation relatively recently, so it's still relatively early days. So far, we have identified 65 officials who have interest in companies doing with business with the Metro and receiving payments as active vendors. And a lot of, when I talk about the business interest, a lot of it is done through that data mining exercise that I talked about earlier. The total value of procurement under investigation is in excess of 80 million. And the irregularities include deviation approvals of over 400 million, collusion between officials and service providers, deviations from the tender specs without authorization, and then payments for work that has not been completed. And Ekurhuleni, we've been working closely with the Metro there. We're currently reviewing 10 waste management tenders involving 19 contractors. The value of the contract is 500 million rand. In one contract, the payment was made of 38 million rand without a delivery note. Nobody can actually confirm whether the goods were delivered or not. We're looking at a number of ICT contracts. One of the contracts of 32 million was awarded to a company with which the executive director had an undisclosed relationship. He has now resigned and is a full-time employee by that company, of that company. And the director of infrastructure also admitted to signing off invoices to the value of 12 million for services that were not delivered. Quite a lot of disciplinary action has already been taken in Ekurhuleni, and a number of people are in the process of being dismissed from the basis of what has been done so far. Rural development and land reform. There, my slide is different again from what's on the paper in front of you. But just to say, this is going to be a very big investigation. The department has invested significantly in this. We have worked with the department on a massive project to capture essentially all the documentation in the in their possession electronically, and essentially to safeguard it. This documentation is mostly still in active files throughout the country. So there was a simultaneous exercise in all the land reform offices. I think we procured about 8 service providers who then went in and scanned and indexed every document in their possession and made them electronically referenceable. Quite a, you know, the biggest exercise of its kind in the history of South Africa. You would have seen already in KZN, there is one of the anti-corruption task team cases of it that SIU, the Hawks, Asset Forfeiture and the Prosecuting Authority has been working together there on a Mr. Superstud and 3 officials. We've seized over 50 million rand worth of assets from them, and including several farms that had been falsely transferred to them. Human settlement is one of our longest running investigations. As I said earlier, the focus is now very much on the contracts. We did a big review with the department, a data mining exercise on all the information on their housing subsidy system database. which indicated that there was probably 50% of all the 10,000 projects that have been funded have problems. Some of the bigger problems is that people are paid for houses which may not exist at all, or are barely, or very incomplete, or very defective, or paying for more houses than was actually built. After the data mining exercise, we have identified 20 cases which appear to have the most serious irregularities, and those are our first investigation. I want to highlight an issue here because I think it's something that this committee should apply its mind to. When we do a housing investigation and we now want to recover from the contractor who under-delivered, especially where it's shoddy workmanship, if the cost to us is about 2 million rand for one investigation. Because you have essentially go to court and prove how much was under-delivered. And if the allegation is that there's too little cement in the basement, and the foundation, I mean, it's not that we need to be bring in very expensive private sector resources to do the quantity surveyors and others to try and quantify what is the damage that government suffered here. You will see that you may remember that the Minister of Finance in his midterm budget speech last year talked about a law which is being looked at the moment, which would ease the burden on the state to prove the damages. I have assisted to those where the serious irregularities were found, or if corruption is found, actually say that we state and claim double the full contract amount from the contractor. But I think if we want to deter some of the serious irregularities and disdain for the law, if I may call it that, we really do need to look at some more drastic measures deterring people from this behavior. The reality here is of the 5,000 contracts that should be investigated, we don't have the capacity to touch even a small portion. We can only try and focus on those that are most serious. Because of the immense cost of trying not to prove the wrongdoing, but to prove the extent of the damages that the state has suffered. And I think that is an issue that we do need some legislative reform. So, of the 20 cases that we are looking at, they are an average of 100 million rand each. Total value there is 2 billion rand. There are lots more to come. Those are done. But our capacity at the moment is really just to be able to do 20 at a time. I want then this to talk about some of the challenges that I think there are in terms of dealing better in corruption from our experience. I think one of the challenges that we do want to raise is the scheme of the PFMA, which is essentially to give accounting officers full power, which is, I think, in general not a bad thing. They are like the CEO of a company. But the difficulty is that when the accounting officer, him or herself, or somebody close to them is implicated in an investigation, you have a situation where internal audit reports to the accounting officer, the anti-corruption capacity reports to the accounting officer. The accounting officer decides who must come and do an investigation when the auditor general says an investigation must be done. Must decide whether to take disciplinary action, whether to take to institute civil litigation, whether to refer the case for criminal action. And that is a serious issue, I think, that our minister has spoken about too. There's a provision in the Prevention of Corruption Act that makes it a criminal offence for senior public servants not to report a suspicion of corruption. Yet these forensic reports lie in government departments, and they are not reported anywhere very often. So I think there is some issues here that does need to be addressed if we are going to deal more effectively with corruption. Some of these issues are under discussion in the Treasury Group as the custodian of the PFMA, but I do think these are some of the systemic issues in a sense that we really have to put our heads together. There's not always easy answers here, but I think that we do have to find some answers to these issues. I think in terms of the SIU model itself, is there ways in which it can be made more effective and sustainable? I think some of the suggestions that we would probably like the committee to think about in future is, and I think one of the suggestions that we've had from Treasury is that we perhaps should look at more auditor general type model, where we don't, where a department just has to pay for the audit. The same way they should pay for the investigation to be done. There is problems, of course, if the department might not have money or sufficient money in its budget, but I think some of the suggestions from Treasury have even been that Treasury can bail them out in a case where there generally isn't enough, where there genuinely isn't enough money. But I think the funding is very often used as an excuse, I think, by a department who doesn't really want to be investigated and know that we don't have the capacity to do it unless we get some additional funding. And I don't think that is very desirable. I also wanted to just mention that there are some amendments to our Act in the Judicial Matters Amendment Act that is coming to Parliament.
The bill.
No, I've been away from Parliament. But I think the scheme of the SIU doing civil litigation and the special tribunal that is in fact established for us to litigate in has just not worked. There's been a number of judgments that question our locus standi to appear at all on behalf of a department or separate from a department. So the minister has agreed with those amendments, and they are, I think they are to be tabled in Parliament fairly soon, we believe. The delays on this has impacted significantly on our ability to actually use civil litigation as envisaged in the law. Some of our personnel information. I have mentioned quite a lot of this already. We do have what may be called 668 funded posts, but about half of our budget, as I said, is from departments paying us at the moment. So it's not always possible to fill all our posts or to fill them with permanent staff, because if that funding disappears, we then sit with posts that have people in them and suddenly become unfunded. So it has been risky for us, and that is to some degree why we've tried to mitigate our risks by using consultants. We use contract workers quite often and temporary staff, especially for data capturers and those sorts of positions where we may not have a long-term sustainable need. But I think given the flood of work that the SIU has received in the last year and the great funding from departments, we are ready with quite an aggressive recruitment drive at the moment. But you will see that our sort of permanent posts have actually declined over the last 3 years or so because of some of the uncertainty about funding. I've already talked about the agreement that we've reached. I wanted to just illustrate the point about the project funding that we get from departments. You will see that's the second line in the table, that 0304 was the first time we made one of these agreements. It was with Directional Services at the time. And so the amount of project funding went up very quickly from 0% to about 60% 4 years later with correctional services, housing, transport, and social development all committing large amounts of funds. We felt that for 60% of our budget to come from unsecured sources was too high a risk, and we have been trying to get that percentage down over the last few years. So at the moment it's about 42-44%. We estimate that current year will end up at 44. New year we will probably be above 50 again because of the additional funding. But it is just an issue that does leave us a bit vulnerable. Mm. We have, as part of government savings measures, also have relatively aggressive cost-cutting measures to try and save on what we can. I'm not going to go too much through the details of our budget figures here. I have put it in so that it is on the record. But we do summarize some of the issues on the next slide. Our funding, as you will know, comes through the department, is channeled through the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, and then is also by charging fees for some of our investigations. Over the NTEF period, our revenue has gone up by about 10% per annum, and it's projected for the next 3 years to increase by about 7.6% per annum, mainly due to some of the additional allocations for increased capacity we've received from Treasury. Expenditure over the last 3 years went up by nearly 15% per annum, also projected to increase by 7.6% for the next 3 years. Most of the increases are due to personnel expenditure and the increase of our capacity. But we also did have a significant use of consultants in our OD process in the 08-09 year, but that process has now been completed. You can see for the next 3 years, there's not really significant increases. We have, I think, about a real increase of about 10 million rand over inflation to be pushed by our investigators for that. In conclusion, I think despite the fact that some of our performance indicators are going to be significantly down, I think that we are making significantly more impact with the kinds of investigations we are doing now. I think they are not just lots of small people who are being touched. I think we are dealing now with some of the people who have been instrumental in significant scale corruption in their departments or outside. I think I've highlighted the challenge that from the massive demand there is at the moment for corruption investigations to be done, and the fact that the capacity in the state at the moment is very, very limited. And then I think the big shift also in the last year, 18 months, has been through our cooperation in the Act, the MOR, the WASP, and I think that those collaborations really for me is the way in which we are going to make a much bigger and wider and collective impact on corruption in the future. Thank you, Jim.
All right. take you in this order, Steve Swart, followed by Dean Smuts, followed by Mr. Jeffrey, followed by Yahoo Shope Sitole, followed by the Honorable Debbie Schaefer. Steve?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Clearly, you've got your hands full, and from our side, we just commend you for the excellent work that you've been doing. Can I just first ask, there was a lot of pressure on you personally to choose between AFU and SIU, and you still are holding both positions. Is there any finalization to that? And then, just as far as the levels of fraud and corruption is concerned, we seem to be losing the battle, because if you look at you've got 18 new proclamations issued, massive size of these investigations. If you take the municipalities, if you take all the various issues, would you agree that, that we seem to be losing the battle in the fight of crime and corruption? And how can we further assist you in this regard? Now, you also never referred to the agreement between ESCOM. Did you? Did you refer to that or not? We understand that there's an agreement between ESCOM and the SIU relating to investigating corrupt practices and conflicts of interest. Maybe a good start would be to investigate negligence at Duva, which caused that old power center to close down 600 megawatts and there's 2 billion rand worth of energy lost. But Chair, there was a lot of concern from the public relating to the majority party's investment on Chancellor House, which was said to receive some 50 million rand over 8 years in profits from that Medupi and Kasili power station. This was according to Hitachi Power Africa, a company wherein the ANC owns a 25% stake through Chancellor House. Now, arising from this agreement that you'll be looking into conflicts of interest, will you be looking into that, particularly in the light of a public protector's report in February last year that found that former ESCOM chairperson Vali Musa had failed to manage a conflict of interest that arose with ESCOM when ESCOM awarded the Medupi contract to the Hitachi Consortium? Now, clearly, our concern relates to conflicts of interest broadly, if you would comment on that. Then secondly, the issue of the SAP headquarters lease and your support for the public protector's report. At what stage are you now able to continue with the recovery of assets? There's an ongoing lease now there's money being spent. That is our concern. Now, we understand that the public protector's report is the discussions at ministerial level, but clearly, there's, on a month-to-month basis, there are expenses being incurred. You've got the power to intervene. Are you able to intervene and to stop those leases through a declaratory order or something like that in court to obtain that order? Chair, those are my initial, but just to commend you for the excellent work that you're doing. Thank you.
Would you prefer to take?
Probably easier than to deal with them one by one.
Right, let's do that.
Now, I might start forgetting some of the questions. Thanks for the commendation from the poisoned telephone. Chair, let me say, on my own position, I have discussed it with the Minister, and I think we have agreed that there should be a proper process of dealing with this issue. I think at the moment there isn't immediate pressure to stop doing 2 jobs for the price of 1. On the issue of are we losing the battle against crime and corruption, I think we should all accept that corruption is a serious problem in our country. And I think the positive thing for me has been that if you don't make that admission first, you are not going to solve the problem. So I think the fact that these targets were escalated into from the presidency down into the justice clusters for me has shown a determination to deal with this problem. I think the transparency index appearing there is an admission that our ranking in TI has slipped significantly over the years, and we need to be doing the things that will improve it. And I think it is inevitable that as we start investigating more seriously what is wrong and building the capacity to investigate more, we will find more things that are wrong. So does that mean there's more corruption? I think it's very difficult to say. But I think what does give me a lot of hope is that I think there's a real determination to deal with corruption. Lots of resources are being devoted to that. I haven't said that much about our collaboration with the Hawks in this regard, but I think that the work that the Hawks are doing with us here has been really impressive. And I think there's really a new thinking there and a focus on doing things better and smarter. I'm hopeful that we are really going to make a difference in the next few years. I don't think there's quick fix answers, but I think that big progress is being made, will visibly be made in the next couple of years as some of these big investigations come to a head. On ESCOM, at the moment, what we have is an agreement with ESCOM to look at their internal issues. We don't have a proclamation yet. ESCOM has indicated that they would like a proclamation that will also allow us to investigate entities outside ESCOM. But at the moment, we don't have powers. We are simply working with ESCOM to assist them in their internal investigations. We don't need search warrants or bank statements or those sorts of things. We are working with them on our data mining tool particularly. We haven't identified very significant conflicts of interest with people in ESCOM doing business to a significant degree with ESCOM, undeclared business. So that is the focus at the moment. I don't want to speculate on what may happen in the month in the future. On the SAP lease, I think that the, as you will have seen, the public protector is still investigating the Durban head office lease as well, which is very much the same role players as involved in the head office lease. I don't want to preempt the outcomes of those, but we have committed to try and ensure that that investigation is done as quickly as possible. I think on whether the SIU can try to make recoveries here, I think that's one of the issues I was highlighting about the accounting officer's role. The accounting officer has to make recoveries. The courts have said we can't do it if the accounting officer doesn't want to do it. So I think that's one of the limitations that we have to look at at the moment. But the public protector did try and address that issue in her report. She asked Treasury to investigate, continue to work on these leases to see whether the leases should be cancelled and what legal action can be taken. So I think that ball in a sense, because of the other issues we face, has been passed to Treasury to deal with. I'm not 100% sure where the money is or even being paid over at the moment.
Thank you. Mr. Hoffman, you were so clear that one didn't feel the need to you were so clear that nobody raised questions of clarification, but please just answer me one thing on the problem with the accounting officers. And it's too interesting. It's the first time I've encountered this, and now it stands to reason. We've had other problems with accounting officers where they were CEOs in the independent institution and wanted to run the place, whereas your commissioner or your other SAP line appointee should be running it. Are we talking about accounting officers of government departments only? Are we in addition talking about accounting officers at other kinds of institutions? That's the single question of clarification. Then I want to ask you two other things. One about your data mining, and you clearly had great success with it. A subcommittee of this committee is at the moment under the chairmanship of the Honourable John Jeffrey writing a law on the protection of personal information. And you're familiar with the kind of field. It will exclude public bodies, provided the laws in place sufficiently address the question specifically of privacy. And it will exclude law enforcement, provided the laws there look sufficiently after privacy. Now, I understood from what you say that you are matching purely public government databases. Is there nevertheless any kind of a danger of intrusion on the private information of citizens? I'm sure it's a question you've asked yourself. So, A, are they purely public databases? Secondly, is there any danger of intrusion on privacy? And I want to ask you a different thing altogether, out of the ballpark, and you may not particularly wish to answer. You are really our only anti-corruption unit, and you do a proud congratulations to all of you for the work you do. The Hawks, and one is glad to hear that they're doing very well. They are not an anti-corruption unit. They are, in fact, a priority crime, a branch of the police. It just seems to me, having now just heard from the Constitutional Court in what I think one can only describe as a really creative majority judgment, let's call it that, that Parliament is now under an injunction to create an independent anti-corruption unit, which must accord with what the majority describes as our native conception of independence. Now, their tests for that thing are usually appointment, tenure, and removal procedures. It seems to me that one possible approach to this problem, I'm aware that the judgment says we have to fix Chapter 6 of the Police Act, let's leave that aside for the moment, but it seems to me one possible way to deal with this is to turn you into our anti-corruption unit, which will meet the dictates, in the view of the majority judgment, of the international law, which on their interpretation has been drawn so deeply, and I use their words, into the heart of our constitution that they have the effect and status of our own constitution, not just domestic law. One of the things that would seem to me to make you suitable is precisely the fact that you don't have powers of law enforcement, you can't arrest, you can't prosecute. And why that to me would be a plus is because of the argument that Chief Justice makes, which in my view is insuperable, inexorably logical, that Section 205 and 206 of our Constitution says a cabinet member is responsible for policing, investigation. Section 205 says the police, and there is one police force, is responsible for investigation and all the rest. I don't know how you overcome that if you also simultaneously want a fully independent body consonant with our native conception of independence. Our native independence, of course, rests on certain Canadian judgments too, but leave that there. So it just seems to me that there must be potential in thinking about augmenting your role. It would imply a different appointment procedure. The President couldn't on his own anymore appoint you, but we could select you and the President do the executive action of appointing. You could be given tenure. The removal provisions could be made similar to those that we have for the Chapter 9. And it just does seem to me one would have to go through the whole OECD report, right, to which they attach such weight. But surely we could tick off enough of the things that have drawn the attention of the majority there to turn you into just the kind of body that would satisfy the court, and we are bound by that judgment. Is it something you have at all thought about, being our only anti-corruption unit? Tell me only if you wish to, whether you would be interested in such a role. You may not wish to comment at all.
Don't call me the return of the scorpion. Comment plus.
Yeah, I think there are serious debates to be had about what is the most effective way of combating corruption in South Africa. And I think some of those debates are happening and were happening before the Constitutional Court judgment. I don't think that it's appropriate for me, though, in public to... I'd love to make an input into those debates, but I don't think in public it's appropriate really for me to be participating in such a debate. I think those are policy decisions that need to be taken. I think our views will be sought on those issues, but I don't think it's for us to sort of kick off the debate.
You're not going to be a politician.
I still have some diplomacy left.
All right. Egyptian.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks to Mr. Hoffmeyer for the very comprehensive report. Maybe just to start where Ms. Smut left off, not on the issues of your personal views, but it would seem to me as though the Glenister judgment, majority judgment in Glenister, raises some questions around the status of the constitutional status of the SIU. I mean, I was in surprising agreement with Ms. Smuts about you know, the creativity or whatever, but you know, given that you are an anti-corruption agency, it would seem that yeah, the majority judgment was also talking to you, even though the SIU wasn't before the court. But basically, my questions are really just on, well, one on procedure. We had a budget review process. You didn't come along. I'm not sure why last year. It's part of the money bills process, the money bills amendment. From the looks on some of your colleagues' faces, I think you weren't invited. But I think, Chair, we need to look at that. Then my understanding is that I can't remember. I mean, everybody's made to submit an annual performance plan. You haven't submitted one. I don't know if you're aware of that. You know, there are reporting mechanisms, annual performance plans, annual reports. I think we just need to look at that aspect for the future, not so much for now. Then I'm very confused around your staffing. I mean, it's something one's been raising with the department and with the NPA about their staffing, so one has to raise it with you. Well, first of all, maybe just a pre-issue before that. I mean, you do get, I know nobody ever said they get enough money, and you get money from the work that you do. But I mean, you're getting a lot. You're getting more than the Human Rights Commission. You're getting more than the Public Protector. Obviously, you've got a lot of work to do, and it's quite costly. But just to make that point, particularly for the media. But anyway, the vacant posts. I'm a bit confused. The 668 funded posts, is that funded in terms of the budget allocation, the treasury allocation that you're getting, or is it funded in terms of, partially in terms of the revenue you're generating? If it's funded in terms of treasury, then I don't understand the vacancies.
The other way around.
Sorry?
It's funded from our total.
From your total income. So it would be useful then to see what is funded from the treasury allocation. And then the figures on the vacancies seem to vary. Estimates of national expenditure, said you had a staff complement in 2009-10 of 530. You're saying 594 in 2007-08, this is now on slide 24. Dropping down to 522 in this past financial year, 2010-11. We were then given, which has presumably come from you, a single sheet dated today, operation summary, 439 full-time operation staff. So I'm very confused as to your staff complement. I hope you are not as confused as I am. Sorry. With the agency stuff, I mean, I see the problem with the Auditor General. I mean, if you're investigating a municipality, for example, they're not going to have money. I mean, particularly if you look at the municipalities that have been placed under administration, they're not going to have the money to pay you to investigate. Maybe Treasury could, instead of bailing them out, pay you for that. It presumably, when any private sector body gets a contract, they then employ, that contract is for a particular period, and they then employ contract staff for that contract, which is the way things work when there's work generated. So I'm not sure why you don't look at that. But then in spite of the budgetary problems, if you look at page 26, you've got a surplus. I mean, as you know, we don't like unspent money. And you've got a surplus in this current financial year of 13 million. So it's a little bit difficult. It's a bit problematic. I know your. I mean, that surplus may not be coming from the treasury amount, but from the money that you generated. But what are you doing about that? I mean, your figures of the surplus seem to vary from 38 million in 2007-08. 3 million, 6 million deficit for the next 2 years, and then back to 13 million, and then you're projecting 13, 14, 16 million surpluses. I'm a bit uncomfortable with that. And then I think, look, there would be room for engagement on the suggestions. I mean, I would be interested in, you know, if with local government, have you had any engagement with the local government portfolio committee or the cooperative governance portfolio committee on proposals on corruption issues? When you were talking about housing and having to test concrete to ascertain the value of the loss to the state, I was wondering to myself why the Department of Housing, nationally or provincially, shouldn't they be conducting those tests as part of the course? I mean, what happens if houses are being, aside from the fraud issue, the corruption issue, if buildings are being constructed and then they collapse and people get killed because they were not, I mean, surely there are building standards, so how does that link in? But yeah, I mean, I think it would be useful. And then the we quite like disclosure provisions. I don't know if that would benefit the SIU's work or not, as to you know which public servants are meant to disclose and what happens and at a local government level as well. I was just sort of wondering, I wonder whether public works, I mean, this is sort of now musing, and I'll stop coming soon, but whether, you know, the service providers who do work for public works, is there any form of security clearance for them? You're building a police station, somebody pays you to build it in a particular way, I mean, the contractor to build it in a particular way so that they can access dockets free prisoners at a later point. I mean, is there anything stopping that? You know, shouldn't there be some kind of security clearance for contractors? I don't know. Anyway, look, those are just sort of some general comments, but my main one was really, Chair, on the formal reporting mechanisms, and I think from both our sides, that's Parliament or National Assembly and the SIU, there are gaps which we need to correct. And then trying to get some understanding of the vacancies, and then lastly, the surpluses.
I knew I should have brought my CFO along with me, but let me say on the vacancies first, the figure that you on here have you on the separate page is operation specific. So that's the number of staff work of the total staff complement that is working on operations. So this is not the total staff complement. The 439.
Yes, no, I gather it's the
439,
but then what do the others do?
We do need some people to run our IT systems and pay the SMT claims and we have the administrative infrastructure. Thank you.
Okay, maybe it's easier for us to see both. To understand it, so that you say, okay, these are the operational staff, these are the yeah, because otherwise, if you give this to us, I mean, what's so important about operation summary?
I think we just wanted to, on one stage, on one page, try and summarize some of our most important operational information, but I should have explained it. I didn't deal with that kind of stuff. But I think on the question of the issues, you know, I think because of our innovation of raising project funding, it does leave us with a sort of complex situation to manage. What we do have some people on contract, but basically if you're trying to recruit people to come and work for you and you say here's a 1 year or a 3 year contract, the quality of person that you get is not great.
Mm-hmm.
So we do take a risk. I mean, we do employ a number of people on contract, especially those that may be difficult to find similar work for them to do on other projects. You know, for example, in social development, we employed a number of people who had skills in going into deep rural areas and finding somebody who lives not at an address, but in some village near to the Honourable Lamisa. You know, but so we employed people who were not, you know, who had some basic investigative skills, but they basically traced it. And so those people may not be usable on another project. And in the licensing investigation, we essentially manually data captured the licensing records of large numbers of driving license testing centers. So a lot of those people we employed as temps from agencies, basically, because even during the duration of the contract, our demand would go up and down, and we didn't have use on other projects for that number of data capturers. So we do try and manage it. We try and employ as many people as we can on a permanent basis because of the quality of person that you can address. We've also, because of government's emphasis on not using temps and labour brokers, we have been trying to see if we can convert at least some of the people we are using on a temporary basis to shorter or medium-term contracts. But, you know, our establishment is very different from a usual government establishment in that sense, that we have a core group of people, but we do need to grow, and sometimes, not too often, but sometimes we have to shrink, or we have to be able to shrink if some of our big projects are not renewed. So we have to build in some of that flexibility. On the question of the surpluses, I may try to be able to answer you on the basis of the figures here, although I hope it doesn't, but I think this is illustrative for the year up to 28 February 2011. But if you look here, what we're talking about is expenses excluding capital expenditure. So that surplus figure you have on the slide is excluding capital expenditure, essentially. So in our actual financial statements, you will see the more detail of how that surplus is spent and what is carried over. But we do have situations, for example, some of the big surpluses in the past is that the Department of Transport were paying us about 20 million a year. The contract started in, I think, late February, early March of a particular financial year. They paid us a year in advance. So we can't spend the money because we need it in the next year to continue funding the investigation. So in those circumstances, the Auditor General gives us permission to roll over the money. We, you know, where money is committed for expenditure in the future years. So you will see that we roll over fairly significant amounts of money every year. But it doesn't mean that we are spending, you know, theoretically the income should only be accounted for in the next year, but we sit with the cash, so we do have to explain the cash in our position. Sorry, you had one other question, I think. Perhaps one of the things I should mention is we haven't been to the local government committee, but one of the things that we have been doing over the last 18 months is work a lot with the National Department of Local Government. So one of the biggest investigations that I haven't talked too much about is, but they refer to all the municipalities in the Northwest Province for investigation. All 23 of them, I think. And I think the Tshwane Metro investigation also had their origins in the National Department. So I think the National Department has been, where they are putting in administrators, they are now often coming to us also to do an investigation. And they have assisted with leveraging the funding, if I can use that word. They've either persuaded the municipality or the province to fund or helped I think on one occasion from the National Department itself with the funding. So I think the issues around local government is obviously serious. I think most of us accept that that's probably where the biggest problems are. But I think the scale of the issues there and the inability to fund investigations is a real challenge.
The Honourable Shabbat Stoller.
sent you Chesterton and Mr. Hoffman. I really admire the way you remain calm when working with such a glaring, organized human dishonesty. I'm just interested in the metro. I see a lot of millions in money, total payment made to this business between 2007 and 2010, amounting to 185 million. I'm also looking at Ekurhuleni. In particular, the ICT contract to the value of 32 million awarded to company with executive director, IT head, and undisclosed relationship. He has since resigned and is now employed full time by the company. I would like to know if you really have any knowledge of what happened to all this. What steps were taken to discipline to recover the money in the first place? Because I'll tell you why I'm so interested in this thing. Because this affects service delivery. And when the communities are up in arms, I and the chairperson must go and face the communities. And the executive director is sitting nicely in his three-story 32 million house, and we must be there and explain to the people when are they going to get proper service. You know, our people have waited for a long time. They've been patient. And we can't have people who actually just close their eyes in front of glaring poverty and just siphon the monies of the state like this. I would like to know what happened to these people, because leaving the post is not an answer that I would like to have. I would like the return of the scarce resources of the state to the state, so that money can do exactly what it's supposed to do. You see, the definition, what is a budget? A budget is an instrument with which the ruling party expresses its policies. When these funds are siphoned like this, it is the ruling party that is hurt the most. And I'm worried about that. And I would like to know what is happening to these people. We can't have people just jumping from post to post and nothing happening to them. Even if you can't give me today, say, I would like to know what happened to all this in Swane, and also Ekurhuleni and the other places, especially this one, because the shock, you know, I come from the rural places. There's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of poverty. I haven't seen with my eyes 12 million, but it seems there are people who can get 12 million very easily and get away with the murder. I'm worried. We as the ANC actually introduced accountability in this country. And we want people to account. We're not going to allow people to get away with murder like this. This money must go back to the state. We don't have a billion just to dish out to people like that.
Sometimes it is difficult to remain calm. But I think we do share your concern that, you know, I think corruption very often impacts on the poorest of the poor, because it is to them that the services are not delivered. I think that is why it is an issue that needs to be addressed very seriously, not just because they are criminals out there doing it, but because the impact of what they are doing affects thousands, if not millions, of people eventually. I think on the Tshwane matter, that's still in a relatively early stage of investigation. In relation to Ekurhuleni, that matter is with the police. I think charges will be brought, and I know that the asset forfeiture unit, although now I mustn't be quoted on that, then some people may read about it in the newspaper, but certainly this case is one of the cases with the anti-corruption task team, and the full force of the law will be brought to bear, and whatever can be recovered will be recovered. So, you know, I think that's one of the issues. I think the difficulty, though, as I said, sometimes where there is not criminal action in these cases possible, you know, then you're in the domain of civil litigation, and then the IT company will say, but we delivered so much value to you, so you can't take all the money back because you got something of value in return, even if you got it corruptly. You know, and I think that's where we do need to look at the element of deterrence in the civil penalties that we impose. Now, there's in a number of the BEE fronting cases, I know that's been charged in court, where asset forfeiture is trying to take the money, the court will say, but the person delivered value for money, even though they committed a fraud. And so the court takes a very lenient view, frankly, of what we believe is a more serious offence. And I think the Supreme Court of Appeal has recently given a helpful judgment saying how serious it is. But, you know, that's part of the difficulty. Somebody will say, okay, you paid us 32 million, but we gave you 30 million rands worth of equipment, and 2 million is a reasonable profit to make. And then the court says, yes, that sounds reasonable. But, you know, that just means there is very little deterrence for people to continue doing these sorts of things. And let me just say, when I talk about civil action, the Americans have similar provisions in their laws, and I think that's where some of the Minister of Finance suggestion comes from. But in many of these cases, it's not always possible to prove corruption beyond the reasonable doubt that you need to put somebody in jail. But in a civil court, on a civil onus, you can prove that it was a corrupt transaction. And it would, in that case, the civil penalties will kick in. Nobody will go off to jail, but in a sense there will be a civil deterrent, at least, that I think can be effective in these cases.
The Honourable
May I just note, I don't think I have answered to my deadline in terms of and whether it impacts privacy. At the end.
Sorry.
Yeah, but it can come at the end.
Okay, fine. Data mining, Willie.
Let me just deal with it quickly while
this
is in my mind. I think we have been meaning to engage with the committee about the privacy issues and so on. I can't say I'm personally an expert. One of our lawyers has looked at the draft legislation. But let's say a practical issue we faced when investigating social grants. We could go to private companies and say, can you cooperate with us and run the social grant database against your payroll? So if we can see here's somebody earning 200,000 rand, but they're also getting a social grant. Now, obviously, we can't do it on any significant scale because we have to go to them one by one and negotiate. I think in the end, we essentially subpoenaed their payrolls from them. But, you know, I think there are cases where the use of data is really invaluable in areas where it has a massive fiscal impact on government, for example. You know, so I think those are just areas that do need to be looked at carefully when you looked at, you know, I don't think anybody needs to have privacy to be able to commit a fraud on government.
Yeah, but
that
your pen can come here.
Yeah. On that front. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, we are at quite an advanced stage for the bill, and other government departments, bodies, had requested amendments, Financial Intelligence Center being one of them. I can't remember who the other one was. So really, I don't think I think it's very good that Ms. Mutz has raised the issue, but it would really be appreciated if you could look at the latest draft and make proposals, or whoever from your section, we're not going to really have time to invite you to come along and talk to us or to muse through your empowering legislation and decide for you what we think is appropriate. You're the hands-on people. You know what you need and what you don't need. So please, as a matter of relative urgency, come and tell us before we finalise.
But you need our latest working draft. You know what you work on something else.
We can contact you afterwards in terms of the officials and stuff. But other bodies just to sort of rub it in, as it were. I mean, other government, other bodies like FIC said they wanted amendments. They've got those amendments.
We must plead guilty here. We have been meaning to do it, but we've been overtaken by the volume of work.
The Honourable Debbie Schaefer, followed by Nkosi Olumisi.
Thank you. Just on the housing issue, I mean, have you had any discussions with the NHBRC? I mean, what is their role in this whole thing? And surely also with the Department of Housing. I mean, I agree with you that there should be deterrence, but I'm not particularly comfortable with the proposals that have been made. I think you're going to have a hard time convincing building contractors to actually enter into those kinds of contracts. And you might well end up finding that they're just not prepared to do the work. Surely the Department of Housing is actually being negligent in not going and checking up on those buildings periodically as they are being built, because that's the stage where you should actually be able to see that it's not being complied with and take action. And maybe that's something you can start talking to them about. I'm still not convinced. I don't understand if I missed it. I'm not quite sure. Sorry about that. But the issue with the lease and the public protector. Under what circumstances are you able, on your own initiative, to institute civil action, for example, to cancel the lease? I didn't skip that point. You know, because now it's gone back to the public protector, then it's gone back to the Treasury, then it's gone back to the Home Affairs Department, and nothing's happening about it, and it's being bounced around from pillar to post, and no one's doing anything about it. I mean, under what legally, what is your discretionary role? I mean, when can you actually just take that on yourself to do it? As far as the government's commitment to corruption is concerned, it doesn't appear to me to be indicated in your budget increases. And have you taken steps to have serious discussions with Treasury about increasing your budget to increase your capacity so you don't have to continually take these risks in contractual appointments and so on? Your what? I like all these things with stings in them. Then take the stings out again, so I hope that's not going to happen with your what as well. How many cases are you currently dealing with in this what? You didn't mention that. I don't know if it was deliberate or if they aren't yet up and running. And this Pretoria lease accommodation intrigues me. I mean,
carry on.
He's not listening.
Carry on.
He's a man, he can't multitask.
At least
he's not reading the paper.
Don't come up there.
The lease agreement for public works, R217,000 per month for residential accommodation. Can you please give us more detail? I can understand if you can't give us specifics, but is it one? You know, house or block of flats, or was it for the staff, or what? Was it one person? How many people? Please, can you inform us? That is outrageous. And then just also for my own clarity, under what circumstances? I mean, my understanding is that you can only do investigations by proclamation. Now you say that SABC has approached you and other places approach you. Under what circumstances can government departments just approach you and to do what? And what is the situation with ESCOM? Did they in fact approach you to do that? Because I think there's a few issues you could assist with in our department, DT sitting down there. For example, systems and things like that.
Let me start from the back, in case I missed some of them. In fact, I think the DG has approached us to assist in the Justice Department, so I think in relation to some of the court problems. And we did have a previous project as well. So we are doing work in the department. I think, let me say that part of the work we do is essentially without proclamation. So initially when we started at the ESCOM now, the proclamation will probably come later. But we can start working with them on
issues that do not involve law enforcement powers being used. So, you know, in that case, we are limited to basically the same as an in-house forensic investigation capacity for that department. We can't go to outsiders, we can't get bank records or any of those sorts of things. But in many cases, one can play a significant role in that. The SABC, did we get a proclamation?
Yeah.
Yeah. The SABC, we do have a proclamation. So, you know, there is serious criminality that is being investigated there. We're also working closely with the Hawks in that matter. I think in relation to the public works case, it is for a big and expensive house, but it is for a house. The issue of our working together with the WASPs, I think one of the priorities that we have identified working with them is that you will remember the Auditor General identified a few years ago about 2,500 public servants doing business with government, also through a data mining exercise, essentially. So the Treasury Group, the morgue, initially took over that process and tried to get some, because then proper investigation must be done. The Auditor General did a data exercise, essentially. So that investigation was pursued quite a lot further through the multi-agency working group, and I think that's one of the priorities for DPSA now, is to look at some of the most serious of those cases, and we've done a lot of work on some of those already, and they should hopefully be processed through the system fairly soon. Some of those cases have also gone to court, actually. I think the issue of budget increases and commitment of government to fight corruption, I think it's not altogether fair to say what you're saying, given the recession that there has been. If you look at our budget increases up to, we had really significant increases in our baseline budget from about 20 million when I started to today, when it is 180 million, I think, due to be next year. So our budget over the years have increased significantly, our treasury budget, separate from what we've raised ourselves. But I think in the last few years, most government departments have been happy to just keep what they have rather than to get any increases in their budget. And unfortunately, we've not been any exception. I think there are some discussions on the go at the moment about further funding for corruption initiatives, and I think some announcements may be forthcoming in a while. I think on the SAPS lease.
So just on that point, to point out, I mean, 207,813
2013, I mean, so doubling in 6 years. You could maybe make the comment that government will be concerned about fighting corruption, and it is about human rights.
If you
don't respond to that.
As it should be.
Yeah, and it should be, because corruption affects
one's
human rights.
Well, yeah, you're right. Of course, you're correct, you're right.
No, but I think if you look at slide 25, our treasury grant in 05-06 was 50 million, and it doubled by 07-08 and tripled by 09-10. So, you know, there was a period when Treasury put big amounts of money into the SIN.
Okay.
Sorry. Back to the head office. I don't know if I should switch off the microphone when I'm talking.
No, no.
The issue about the SIU doing civil litigation, as I said, it's in general just not possible when the accounting officer doesn't want to do the civil litigation. The accounting officer is the person with locus standi in the courts. So our court, you know, that is where, to a large degree, we've been crippled. I think the amendments we're asking for the law at the moment is for us to be able to do civil litigation where the accounting officer agrees that we should do it, but we can do it in the estate. It doesn't solve the bigger problem that I raised. It just solves the problem that we ourselves can't actually do civil litigation even though we are geared up to do it. So, as I said, that's a discussion, a bigger discussion than just the SIU. The public protector's solution to that, and that was a recommendation, is that Treasury should look at it and take the necessary three steps, you know, which may mean persuading the accounting officer to do it or whatever.
Yes.
Which they carry a lot of persuasive value.
You're being very diplomatic.
But, you know, I think it's been trying to find a solution in the context of the PFMA, which essentially gives the powers to the accounting officer to do certain things. On the issue of you know, I've become a hawk. I was a hawk long before the hawks were started. But the suggestion isn't simply that one should be able to recover some sort of punitive damages in cases where there is no wrongdoing. It is to say that if in a civil case you can prove corruption would be one option. So you can't prove the corruption beyond a reasonable doubt, but you can prove it on a balance of probability. Then you can recover punitive damages. That's not such a novel concept in civil law. But the problem, no, the reality is that when the housing departments in the provinces are supposed to certify, sign certificates. But, you know, government finds it difficult to employ real experts to do that. You know, people go, they may look at the houses, they may count the houses, but can they say, you know, this is
kosher,
you know, if there's not enough cement in the walls, these things tend to become... No, one of the more difficult is cement is just diluted. You know, so yeah, it's not immediately evident that there is something wrong.
More sand than cement in the mix.
But, you know, so there isn't quick fix answers here, is what I'm trying to say, but it is a big and significant problem. Even some, frankly, let me also say that one of the things you learn in our profession is that the professionals are no longer honest. Whether they are doctors, accountants, engineers, or whatever, everybody
they're at the top of the list.
In deference to my department. No, lawyers can be the most crooked. But the problem is, you know, when large amounts of money is at stake, most people or many people are viable. Fortunately, and if we don't have the systems and the ability to take action in place, there's very little deterrence. And I think that is our challenge to a large degree. I think the Honourable Jeffries did ask me about our annual performance plan, which I forgot to answer, and he didn't chastise me, but I am assured that we will be tabling our annual performance plan before the deadline, which is, I think, the end of the month.
Thank you, Chair President. My question, the first one, relates to the quotation by Kofi Annan from him, where he talks about the impact of corruption on the poor. In the course of your work here, have you been able to establish the number of human beings who have been adversely affected by these acts of corruption in various departments and institutions of state? I also wanted to ask the question, but it has sort of been addressed to. I was worried about the fact that part of your budget was dependent on departments calling on you to come and investigate and pay you for your services. And I was going to ask us what happens if there are not any departments that are forthcoming calling on you. But it seems as if the money you've been getting from Treasury is enough. But you might want to comment on that. On page 6, Chairperson, the strategic goal, one of them is to contribute to the reduction of corruption. Why can't it be the elimination of corruption? Because it has been accepted that it is not possible to achieve that goal, being naive to think it can be. On page 7, Chairperson, there's reference to corruption by officials within the JCPS. Can you indicate the extent to which the officials are involved? I mean, the extent to which officials in this particular cluster are involved, because these are the people who are supposed to be fighting corruption. The other question is relates to the 100 people who have assets of more than 5 million rand that will be successfully convicted. What is the basis of this number? Are you able to indicate? And I think the last one that was referred to the question of officials who are in the process of being dismissed. Would have wanted to know that there should be something more than the mere dismissal that this is. I think you did indicate that one of your aims is to recover whatever it is that has been stolen. Thank you, Shabbat.
The number of people affected by corruption, I think, is very difficult to say. You know, the victimization surveys that have been made, for example, shows probably about 1.5 million adults a year are asked to pay a bribe, and about half of them pay. There are not people offering to pay a bribe because they didn't think that they would get an honest answer. But so I think that's one aspect. But I think the bigger aspect that Kofi Annan also alludes to is that I think a significant amount of our national budget is going to waste. Because I think this Intaka Savoy case is a good example. You take equipment that is worth 500,000 rand and you sell it to government for 5 million rand. And you pay somebody a million rand bribe to buy it for 5 million rand. So, you know, there are cases where we can't show the bribe. We just know people are paying very high prices. You buy a loaf of bread for 26 million rand, 26 rand, as the Minister of Finance has pointed out. So, you know, I think there is a significant amount of wastage apart from corruption as well. I think one of the innovative things that, again, we're discussing in the Treasury group is that you will know the KZN Department of Finance has introduced a database of prices. So they said if you buy a pencil, actually it can't be more than 20 cents. If you buy a pen, this is the maximum that you can pay. And I think that is an important part of it, because with a three-quote system, you very often find, actually, you've asked from your random database, as you're supposed to do, you choose three very expensive people, and you pay double what you're supposed to pay. And you followed all proper procedure. I mean, I've had personal experience of that, and just said, no, we can't actually do that, even though that is the process that is prescribed. So I think that is part of what we need to do. But you know, I think there is, in many places, the amount of money lost through outright corruption is incredibly high. I think the sort of, you know, the other phenomenon that is again more difficult to deal with is what I now call the javelin throwing or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you do a favor for somebody, but you don't get anything. You rely on the fact that in 5 years' time you're going to get something. It's very difficult for us to prove that there's corruption in a case like that until it happens 5 years later. So, you know, the sophistication with which things happen do become a challenge as well. I think on the JCTS corruption, it is difficult, again, to say what is the extent. I know the DG is working on a so-called baseline report, but if that's really saying what it is we have detected, it's not. Now, I think, again, there has been, that survey asking about bribes. If you look at that, top of the list is Metro Cops, about 400,000 cases a year. Third on the list, I think, is police, 100,000, 150,000 a year. But if you look at the number of cases in the system, they're small, because those things are not detected easily. And I think the challenge for us is going to be to say, you know, what is it that we could put in place to make sure that we get a better idea of what the scale of the problem is? And I think the initiative that the Minister of Transport took recently with its national hit squad, I'm sure that's not the proper name, but people who can actually drive around and be stopped by traffic policemen and be asked for bribes and catch, those are the sort of things we need to look at if we want to deal with corruption in the justice system, because the difficulty is, and I think why that issue has come onto the scorecard that was given from the presidency to our minister, is that you can't fight crime if you can't trust the people that you are working with.
Yeah.
Not to be bought. And, you know, I think, again, it is a recognition that we have a serious problem and that we need to deal with it seriously. It's difficult to say what is the scale of that problem. The 5 million rand, I'm not sure how that this is anything very scientific, but my understanding from what the presidency did is they say there's a perception that in South Africa the rich and powerful get away with corruption.
Yeah.
That the justice system is dealing with the small players only.
Yeah.
And they said if we want to change perceptions about South Africa, we want to change behavior in South Africa, then the rich and powerful has to be seen to be brought to book as well. And I think the definition of rich and powerful that they eventually came up with is people who made a lot of money from corruption and still have a lot of money.
Who precisely the president said that?
That's the Monitoring and Evaluation Unit, I think, worked. But ultimately these were all, discussed with the president, and this is what he put in the delivery agreement with the ministers. I think on the issue of budget, in the good times, I think the model that we've developed of getting people to pay is good, because it's meant extra resources being made available. Most of that money probably would have been spent on the private sector. So we really think spend the money in the state, and it helps us to build capacity in the state rather than in the private sector. The difficulty with the model is when the hard times hit, like a recession, and all departments are suddenly trying to save money. So I don't think the model itself is a bad thing, but our suggestion, and I think Treasury is sort of thinking about that, they've raised it also, is that in a sense, they can say, okay, there's a bailout fund available.
Yeah.
Employ the people, build the capacity in the state. If things go terribly wrong, there will be money available to pay for those investigations, even though the department can't pay. So I think those are the sort of examples that one can explore. But the reality is, with this model, our budget has gone up from 20 million 9 years ago to whatever it is now.
Yeah.
No, the total budget's gone up to about 380. Now our budget's gone up 20-fold in 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
Half of it coming from Treasury, basically, and half of it from additional funding. So I don't think it's a bad idea to do it if one can deal with the instability that may arise. It hasn't actually arisen in a serious way, in a crisis way yet, but we always have to plan for it. So you can't employ people permanently. You have to employ some significant portion on short-term contracts. and that means you don't get the best you can, you don't invest that much in those people that you would otherwise, and so on. And I agree, we can't eliminate corruption, but we do need to reduce it dramatically.
Mr. Hoffmeyer and your team, I think you've heard the expressions of appreciation, and they speak far more loudly than I would. But the FIU is and remains the center of excellence, and I think we need to put that on record. You've pointed out some of the anomalies, and we've noted them, and these must be addressed, either through debates in this committee or elsewhere. One of these anomalies, in my view, is that the SIU will recommend that certain people are charged, arrested, and prosecuted, and we don't see it happening. Certainly I don't. And there are others as well. So one hopes that the proposed Judicial Matters Amendment Bill seeks to address at least some of these anomalies, including the SIU's ability and locus standi to do civil litigation. Suddenly we're looking forward to that piece of legislation. whereas yesterday we were told it deals with the High Court in Bumalanga, the High Court in Limpopo, and they said, oh, well, thank you, Willie. Thank you to you and your team. We can only say keep up the good work. Where we're able to, we undertake to give you our support and help. I don't know what happened before my appointment as chairperson, but that's another matter. Suffice to say that when necessary, we will ask you to come and speak to us. So thank you, and we're adjourned.